Thanks for that interesting introduction. I have a very weak voice, so I want to make sure I can be heard in the back. The people in the back, can you hear me okay? Good. Hans is known far and wide as a person who doesn't tolerate fools gladly. I see a different aspect of him. I've agreed to speak here two or three or four times, and each time I reneged. And Hans, one of my oldest and dearest friends, instead of yelling at me, screaming at me, it was very nice. In the words of Murray Rothbard, he's a sweetie pie, even though people see him very differently. I want to congratulate him on his birthday and also him and Gulchen on the arrival of their first few grandchildren. May there be many more in the next few years. I'm delighted to be here. My topic is market failure. What is market failure? Market failure is activities that occur in the free enterprise system such that government intervention could improve matters. And I'm going to go over four or five of them. And sometimes it's seen that there are really two free enterprise schools of thought. One is the Chicagoite and the other is the Austrian. I'll be giving you a mainstream view of all these market failures, which the Chicago school supports. So you can see that there's going to be a big difference between the Chicago so-called free market perspective and the Austrian perspective, which rejects all market failures. There are no market failures for the Austrians. It doesn't mean that individual entrepreneurs never make mistakes. Sometimes they do, often they do. But there are market forces that prevail. When you make a mistake, you lose profits. If you lose too many profits, you have less resources. So in equilibrium or in the evenly rotating economy, which we never reach but we're always approaching, there are no market failures of that sort. Okay, the first market failure is income inequality. Believe it or not, if we don't have absolute income inequality, that's a market failure, and the government can get involved. For example, Milton Friedman believes in the negative income tax. And why does he believe in the negative income tax? Because of the inefficiency, so-called, of any income inequality whatsoever. So here we put money, and here we put utils, and we have diminishing marginal utility, which means that the first dollar that you get gives you a lot of utils, and the last dollar you get gives you many fewer utils. Think of a rich guy over here, Bill Gates, and here's a poor guy, and Bill Gates lights his cigar with $100 bills, so he gets a little bit of utility out of his last $100, but not that much, whereas the poor guy is the difference between starving and not starving. So for him, any dollar that he gets is very, very valuable. So if we take away, say, $1,000 from him, and we move in that direction, namely he is now impoverished or made poorer by $100 or $1,000, and we give that money to this poor guy, what we do is we lose this amount of utils and we gain that amount of utils, and the difference between the two is that amount. See how wonderful government can be? You take money from the rich guy, you give it to the poor guy, and you increase utility. Magnificent. Let's hear a round of applause. No. Oh, I forgot to give you a trigger warning. I might be saying something that will offend neoclassical economists. And if you want a safe space, go to any university in the United States, and there'll be safe spaces for you there. Okay, so that's the argument. I mean, this is Milton Friedman's negative income tax argument, the theoretical argument for why we should have this. And now for the Austrian criticism, and what I'll do is I'll give you several market failures and then several criticisms from the Austrian point of view. Okay, for the first criticism is the whole idea of putting utils on a diagram means that we're into not ordinal utility, but cardinal utility. Cardinal utility means we count utils, namely this amount of dollars gives you that many utils, maybe 25 utils. But that's silly. There's no such thing as cardinal utility or counting. There's only ordinal utility. I like this tie better than your tie. I like vanilla ice cream better than chocolate ice cream, or vice versa. That would be legitimate from the Austrian point of view. But to say that this pen has 10 utils and this watch has 100 utils, and therefore I like the watch 10 times as much as the pen, is just silly. And yet that's what the mainstream, that's what this is predicated on. Okay, so that's one criticism. The whole diagram is nonsense. Nonsense on stilts. Nonsense on stilts, not only because we have cardinal utility, but we have interpersonal cardinal utility, which is sort of even worse than ordinary cardinal utility, because we're here, we're comparing how much a rich guy values money versus how a poor guy values money. And that's silly. Okay, but now let's just assume that this whole thing is legitimate. Why do we have one utility function? Maybe we should have another one like this. Here's another utility function. And now, if we take money away from the rich guy, I should have drawn it a little higher here. If we take money away from the rich guy, we're actually losing more utils than we're gaining utils. Do you get that? Do you see the point? In other words, if the rich guy is over here, and the poor guy is over here, we're actually taking more utility away from the rich guy than we're giving to the poor guy. And what's the justification for putting them both on the same curve? There is no justification. They just put them on one curve. But if we even, in other words, even if we reductio ad absurdum kind of an argument, we assume that the whole thing is legitimate, there's cardinal utility, there's interpersonal comparison of utility, still, why should we put them on the same curve? You put this guy on this curve, and now you're taking more utils from him than giving to that guy. For example, the rich guy is has a well-developed sense of style or whatever, and the poor guy's just a homeless bum, and you give him money, he's going to just waste it on getting drunk. So maybe what we should do is take money from the poor guy and give it to the rich guy. So you can't really prove anything with this, and yet that's what these people rely on. Okay, the second set of market failures is a thing called externalities. And there are positive externalities and negative externalities. Positive externalities are called external economies. Negative externalities are called external diseconomies. And we had Olivier talking about education. And education is usually the example of an external economy, or a positive externality. And again, Milton Friedman, this is based on his voucher plan. Okay, so what's going on here? Here you have supply and demand of education. So this is the quantity of education, and this is the price of education. And what you have is the normal supply and demand curves. And this would be the actual amount of education. I'll call it QA for actual amount of education. And what's going on here, we're mainly concerned with the demand curve, and this is a private demand curve. Namely, what's predicated on this demand curve is private benefits. Why do you want to go to school? Well, to get a better job, to meet a better spouse, to the enjoyment of education, things like that. But, says the mainstream economists, that's not the whole story. There are positive spillover effects. Namely, if you are more educated, you're less likely to be a criminal, you're more likely to vote better, you're better, more likely to be a good citizen, things like that. We had a lecture here yesterday which said that if you're more educated, you're more likely to make a contribution to society. So this is the idea here. And when we take that into account, see, what we have sort of hidden behind this is we can add up demand curves. So if this is a price and that's a quantity and this is demand curve one and this is demand curve two, how do we get the total demand curve of D1 plus D2? We add them up, namely at this price, so much is bought, at that price, so much is bought. Well, at the same price, we add it up. So if 8 are bought here and 12 are bought here, then we have 20. So we have demand curves. You can add up a demand curve. How many people are familiar with this sort of a thing? How many people have never seen anything like this and think I'm sort of lying through my teeth? Okay, well, hopefully I'm expressing it in a way that even if you aren't familiar with this, you can understand where I'm coming from. So let's get back to this demand curve. And see, what we have here is this is the private benefits of education. But then there are these public benefits, these spillover effects. If I'm educated, I benefit you. If you're educated, you benefit me. So if we have, say, the public, this is the demand public, now we get a total demand curve. Namely, I'm adding up these two demand curves and getting a bigger demand curve. And this is the quantity, not actual, but this is the quantity ideal. Namely, what we really, this is a market failure. Namely, we should have more education than the private market will give us. That's the burden of it. Namely, because this is the true demand curve, the sum of the other two demand curves. And if we just look at the private demand curve, that's the actual amount in equilibrium. But we really want more education than the market will give us. So now we have a voucher plan or a subsidy for education or this or that or something like that. So this is a market failure. And this is the story that you would get from a mainstream economist like Milton Friedman. And that's why the market fails. And we need more education, and whether we subsidize or tax or whatever, we just have to move to the right from the quantity actual to the quantity ideal. Well, now what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this is just a bunch of lines written on a blackboard. I mean, anyone can write any lines that they want. Where do you see, in the market, we know for sure, like I bought this watch for $20, we know that I valued it at more than $20 when I bought it. Otherwise, why would I buy it for $20? And we know that the guy who sold it to me had thousands of watches. Why, he valued it less than $20. So there was mutual gain in the market. But here, there's no proof of anything. This is just lines on a blackboard. And I can make the very opposite case. You know, they take surveys of where the minimum wage law is most supported. And where Bernie Sanders gets the most support, and it's in the People's Republic of Ann Arbor, the People's Republic of Cambridge, Massachusetts, the People's Republic of San Francisco. And what's in all these public People's Republics? Education. I mean, they're taking queer studies, they're taking feminist studies, they're taking black studies, they're taking IVA studies, all sorts of studies. And what they learn is a negative amount. Namely, they learn this economy. They learn the opposite of economics. Namely, what we should do is have less education. We ought to tax education. So using their same model, I can come up with the exact opposite conclusion of what they're coming up with, namely that their model is highly problematic. Okay, now I'm going to do a third, market failure. And the third market failure is a thing called external diseconomies or negative externalities. And the usual case here is pollution. So again, we have supply and demand. There's supply, there's demand, there's quantity, there's price, and everything is okay. And now we have, let's say, this table. I'm in, my manufacturing company makes these tables, a little glass, a little wood, a little metal, and now we're focusing mainly on the supply. And what's behind supply, what's behind demand is utility, what's behind supply is cost, so we have marginal costs here. And these are private costs. Again, we have the private versus the public. So what are the private costs? Well, I have to pay for the raw materials. I have to pay my workers. If I had a loan, I have to pay interest. I had to buy a factory. These are all private costs. And this is the actual amount of quantity actual. That's the actual amount of these tables that I'll be producing. However, there are spillover, not benefits, as in the education case, but now there are spillover costs. What are the spillover costs? Pollution. When I make these tables, out comes the smoke from the chimney and it gets on your laundry. In the old days when we didn't have dryers and you hung up your laundry on a clothesline, or in your lungs goes the pollutants. And if we take into account those costs, the real costs are this supply prime. And now, what we should have, because this is a market failure, what we really should be is not at point A, but we should be at point B, namely, this is the quantity ideal. We should have less, fewer tables like this made. And now they have a debate, Pigou and Coase, and they all disagree as to how we get from QA to QI. Should we tax? Should we give a subsidy so that they won't do it? Or should we just compel them to produce less? That's a minor point. But they all agree we have to move to the left because we have too much, because we have market failure. So much for the mainstream view. The correct view, the Austrian view, and here, the best thing ever written on air pollution, as far as I'm concerned, was written by Murray Rothbard in 1980 or 82. It was written in the Cato Journal, and it was something, air pollution, I forget the rest of the title, a long, long title. And what Murray says is things like this. He says, look, in the 1830s, there was a spate of nuisance cases, law cases on a nuisance. We would call them pollution cases, but they were nuisance cases, and you'd get some little old lady who hung up her laundry on a clothesline, and that factory over there polluted it. She put out laundry that was clean and wet. She comes back 3 hours later, it's dry, and now it's dirty. And she goes to court, and she wants two things. She wants damages, and she wants a letter from the court saying that if you keep doing this, we're going to put you in jail. Or another case, a bunch of cases where a farmer would have a haystack and the railroad would come by and the sparks would go 300 feet and we'd get his haystack on fire. And he would go to court and then demand an injunction. An injunction means a letter from the court saying, you know, cut it out because you're trespassing either smoke particles or fire and stop it, and we want damages. Did the plaintiff always succeed? No. But the courts were sort of open to this. And this had salutary effects, namely the manufacturers of these tables would be led by Adam Smith's invisible hand to use clean burning anthracite coal instead of dirty burning sulfur coal, even though the sulfur coal was cheaper, because if you use the sulfur coal, you'd get the little old ladies and farmers on your case and demanding injunctions and damages. So the market was led toward using cleaner coal. It was led toward putting things in the smokestack that would capture the pollutants before they got out. The railroad was led by, again, by the invisible hand to capture the fire before it got onto the farmers' haystacks. And there was even a thing, environmental forensics, namely, if you can sue somebody based on the pollutant, well, you have to know where did the pollutant come from. I mean, for us, forensics is a crime, you know, the hair follicles and the stuff under your fingernails and semen and stuff like that to find out who raped or who murdered somebody. Well, we had environmental forensics, and was it perfect? No, the actual reality is never perfect. The courts were not always doing the right thing, but there was a tendency toward clean air. That was in the 1830s and 1840s. Then come the progressive period, 1890s through 1910. And from the US perspective, who was number one in the world? England. We wanted to be number one. We want to have a greater, you know, make America great or something like that. So the next time some farmer comes into court or some little old lady comes into court complaining about manufacturing, the court says, yeah, they're violating your private property rights, all right, but there's something more important than private property rights, and that's the public good. And what does the public good consist of? Manufacturing. So we're going to ignore your plaintiff case, and we're going to let them do their thing. And now we have sulfur coal instead of anthracite coal, and we have no more environmental forensics, and nobody's worried about pollutants getting out anywhere. They did offer a SOP to the plaintiff. They said, well, we'll have minimum smokestack height regulations. Before, the smokestack was 10 feet high or 20 feet high. Now the smokestack had to be 200 feet high. And now nobody knows where the pollutants are coming from, so of course we're going to have a failure. We're going to have too much pollution. But this is hardly the market's fault, and part of the market is a legal system which respects private property. So that would be the Austro-libertarian critique of this so-called market failure. It was a government failure. There are always government failures. My view is that every failure we have is a government failure, and I don't care what it is. Cancer, underarm smells, whatever. It's always the government's fault. Because the government takes half the GDP and wastes it, and with part of what they take from us, they make us less efficient. And if they didn't do it, maybe we'd cure cancer. Maybe we would make it rain when we wanted it to rain and not when it wanted to rain, whoever it is. So all problems are government problems. No market failure, just government failures. Okay, the next one is monopoly. Now here, Austrians and neoclassicists disagree very heavily. For the Austrian point of view, what a monopoly is a law prohibiting entry. The taxi cab industry is a monopoly because Uber can't go in certain cities. In the medieval times, you fought the good battle and the king would give you a monopoly over salt or sugar or whatever it was, candles. And you could allow other people to make candles if you were the monopolist, but you would charge them to do it. And anyone making candles without your permission would go to jail. That's what monopoly means. For the mainstream, that's also monopoly, but there's an additional amount of monopoly, namely number of competitors. If there's one if there's only one person in the field, that's a monopoly. Two, it's a duopoly. A few, it's an oligopoly. A dozen or so, it's imperfect competition. What they want is perfect competition where there are millions of producers of everything. And if we don't have it, we have to have antitrust. Now, I'm going to draw a diagram that people here might be familiar with if you know a little bit of economics. Here's an average cost curve. Here's a marginal cost curve. That's price and that's quantity. This is a demand curve. This is a marginal revenue curve. And here would be where the perfect competitor is, and here where marginal costs and marginal revenue would be the quantity of the monopolist, this would be the quantity of the competitor, and we move up the demand curve, and here would be the monopolist, and this is the price of the monopolist, and this is the price of the competitive industry. How many are familiar with this sort of a diagram? Okay. The indictment of monopoly is that the price of monopoly is higher than the price of competition, and higher prices are no good. Don't ask why. Somehow, the quantity of competition is more than the quantity of the monopolist, and more quantity is good, and they never justify why that is true. The third one is that there are profits that the monopolist makes. This would be the profit area, and there are no profits for the perfect competition, and profits are evil. Don't ask why, but profits are evil. And the fourth one is a thing called dead weight loss, where we value the quantity under the demand curve there, and it only costs us this much, and this is the dead weight loss. A more simpler version of this would be an oasis. And here in the oasis, there's marginal cost because you now own an oasis and you don't have to do anything. People come with a pot and they dip it in and then they pay you and everyone's honest and you don't have to worry about them. So there's the marginal and the average cost. And here is a demand curve. I should label my axes. There's the quantity of the competition. And here is the marginal revenue curve. So here is the monopolist. How much will the monopolist charge? He'll charge so that this rectangle or this square is the biggest, whereas there are no revenues here. So again, the price of the monopolist is higher than the price of the competition, namely zero, and the quantity of competition is higher than the quantity of monopoly. That's no good. Here is profit, which is evil. Here is the dead weight loss. So it's a simplified version of what I just gave you. But again, the problem is interpersonal comparison of utility. Think of Djokovic. Djokovic is the best tennis player. How many tournaments does he enter a year? Let me get this diagram out here again. Let's say Djokovic enters 25 tournaments a year, but he should really enter 35 tournaments a year because we value the extra 10 tournaments, the area under this part of the demand curve more than he disvalues the extra cost. The extra cost is he'll get a sore shoulder, stuff like that, if he enters into too many tournaments. So what these people, these neoclassical economists, have the audacity to tell us is that we should force Djokovic to play more. Which is, you know, nonsense. Nonsense on stilts. They never apply it to that. And then what they'll do is they'll either break up the monopolist. I don't know how you break up Djokovic into 20 Djokovic's. Or you just nationalize it so that the government will do it. And we know that the government can do things very well and take over this industry here. Let me just do quickly the fourth one. The fourth one is a thing called... So to just finish the monopoly thing, again, it's interpersonal comparison of utility. They're saying that the cost of this guy is greater than the benefits of that guy, and they just make it up. And yet that is what underlies antitrust. Oh, I have to say one good thing about Milton Friedman. What he says is, look, pursuing an antitrust case is costly. And if the deadweight loss is less than the cost, well then, we shouldn't pursue it. Only if the deadweight loss are greater than the cost. And what this is really is a full employment law for economists who will now figure out what the deadweight loss are based on interpersonal comparison utility. It's just crazy. Okay, here's the last one. I've only got another minute or two. This is a thing called public goods. Public goods is another market failure. And what public goods consists of is excludability and rivalrousness. So what's excludability? Excludability means, can you exclude a non-payer? It doesn't have to be perfect. You can exclude the person who buys a hot dog from not paying, because if the guy grabs the hot dog and runs away, you call the cops. Is there 100% excludability? No, 99%. So that's private good. I'm giving you the mainstream view of this. How about a busy street? Can you exclude people? Well, I come from New Orleans. We have Bourbon Street on a Friday night, especially during Mardi Gras. I mean, you know, it's just wall-to-wall people, thousands, tens of thousands of people. The cop is going to go and say, did you pay to be here? Did you pay to be here? It's non-excludable. So if it's excludable, then it's a private good. If it's non-excludable, it's a public good. The radio and TV, is it excludable? Yes. I broadcast a TV show, and then I jam it, and then I sell you an unjamming device, so I can exclude you if you don't pay. How about the lighthouse and defense? According to these people, no. You can't exclude people from national defense, and Hans, I think, has made great contributions to privatization of national defense. And one of the arguments is you can't exclude beneficiaries, because if we tell the bad guy, whoever the bad guy is, Saddam Hussein or Hitler or whoever is going to come over, you know, we're going to protect this guy, we're going to bomb you if you attack us, well, you protect the non-payer also. So you can't exclude people from the benefits of a public good. And the same thing with the lighthouse. Okay, so what's rivalrousness? Rivalrousness is, are we rivals for the item? Yes, we are rivals for the hot dog, because if I'm eating the hot dog, you can't have it. We are rivals for the shirt, because if I'm wearing the shirt, you can't wear the shirt. So that's a private good. But we are not rivalrous with regard to radio and TV, because if you are watching a show and somebody else starts watching the show, they don't stop you from watching the show, so we're not rivals. So therefore, the government should take it over. And the same thing with defense and the lighthouse. So if we have excludability and rivalrousness, you have a pure public good. If you have either one, you have a semi-public good. Okay, this is the mainstream view. Now let me give you very briefly, because I'm running out of time, the Austrian criticism. The first Austrian criticism is, just because the government can't exclude you doesn't mean private people can't exclude you. I do race walking, I do a marathon, half marathon. The Boston Marathon and the New York City Marathon, they'll have 30,000 people. And they want to exclude non-payers. So how do they do that? They give you a little thingy put on your chest that you pin it up with a safety pin. And if you have one, that shows you paid. And if you don't have one, the cops will arrest you for theft of services. Well, we can exclude people from Bourbon Street. If you don't have that little thing, we'll arrest you. Will we get everyone? No, it'll only be 99% effective, but that's fine. The same thing with the lighthouse. I've written several articles defending the lighthouse against Coase, who doesn't understand lighthouses, even though he's written about that. And what I say is, look, suppose this half of the room have paid me to put on my lighthouse, and you dirty rats over here, you haven't paid me. I have a credible threat against you guys. This is in the days of the sailing ship. We didn't have GPS 200 years ago. And what I do is I have a credible threat against you people who were free riding. I say, look, one of these days, none of these people will be out there. And I'll be able to see because I can tell the silhouettes of the sailing ships. And I'll turn the lighthouse off. And then you guys will crash on the rocks. You're going to have to pay your sailors more than these guys because the sailors will be afraid to go on your boat because of this threat. It won't be every day, but one of these days I'm going to get you. And it's the same thing with national defense, but I don't have time to get into that, and my time is up. Thank you.